Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million. Well, I'd buy.
Well, welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Allen, on the board. SP Futures up 28. As that futures up 182 as the big celebratory rally or whatever this is keeps continuing. Netflix to the moon. We've got a couple earnings. Everything is buoyant. Good day for the clients. Good day for everybody yesterday, I guess. We'll just hope it keeps going, I suppose. We don't know where we're going, but we're well on our way. We have Professor Kevin.
Good morning.
How are you?
I am doing just fine this morning.
We were a little stuck. We couldn't. The front door is giving us issues again, but we're here.
You need a key to the back door too.
Is everybody just incompetent in the world today, or what? Nobody can fix anything.
Well, that's probably true.
It's
widespread incompetence.
We have
be a good name for a bad softball team.
Well, the building has a new management company. Of course, they got to get rid of all the old people that did stuff correctly and bring in all new people, right? Cheaper. How do you think that's working?
It doesn't sound like it is. It's actually a little unusual in most businesses when a management company takes over. They want to hire some of the people that have been there so that they have continuity and so that they have some people who know how things work.
They ended up firing two ladies to clean the office at night. They both were making $18 an hour and worked 20 hours a week. That ended up being the huge cost savings.
Would they knock it down to 15?
No, they just get rid of them.
Oh, so nobody cleans the office?
Well, then they made the two janitor guys come in at 5 o'clock and clean offices to keep their jobs.
Oh, and then they get to be the janitors, too.
Yeah, they get to do everything.
All right.
Yeah. So that's your huge cost savings. What is it?
Yeah. What did the building get a big cost savings? And did that?
Let's say $700 a week. That's what I count. It's not a whole lot.
Did what? How much of that do you get?
Zero.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do they clean just as well?
Oh no. What are you talking about? The two girls have been doing it for 10 years. They take care of everything for you. They clean your desktop to clean everything. No, nobody's doing that.
Well, that doesn't sound like smart business to me. But, no. Hey, that's just me.
Well, when you have the owner retires and gives the place to his daughter, who only wants to show up once a month, doesn't really have any interest. She's never even been here. They've never had any interest, and all of a sudden it's hers.
She's never called on the people who hold leases in there?
No, God, no. Nobody's
never done a sit-down to introduce herself and make sure that you knew how to find her if there was ever anything that you needed to discuss?
Oh, no, nothing like that.
What the hell is wrong with people? that's just normal business practice.
I think we're an entire society, and that's why I'm more nervous than most about the new administration because I think it's not just a person; it's the sign of the times, Kevin. And I don't know what the times are. I was in I stopped downstairs. We worked late, and then I was going to give a guy a ride home. And so I stopped downstairs, started talking to a dude, and met him for the first. Well, I've known him, but we started talking a little bit about some of the executive orders. And you know, he's a regular guy. He voted for Trump. It's okay, you know, and he doesn't look like he's a crazed zealot or anything. He just just a regular guy that voted for Trump, didn't like the other side. I surely understand that. And we started talking about the Birther Amendment. You know, he signs the executive order yesterday to essentially get rid of an amendment. And I don't know why he thinks he can do that, but he did it.
Well, it'll get challenged in court.
But what a waste of time. So the guy looks at it and he goes, well, that amendment was there for slaves, and the Supreme Court decision was 1898. Well, that was a long time ago. We don't care about that anymore. I'm like, okay. If we start doing...
You can overturn. Obviously, we saw that with Roe. You can overturn Supreme Court decisions, but the Supreme Court can overturn Supreme Court decisions, and they really only have, basically two reasons that they can do that. Either the facts have changed, the circumstances have changed. In other words, scientific discovery would be an example, things that you learned that you didn't know before. And the other one is if it is deemed to have been wrongly decided in the first place, like, separate but equal, which was considered wrongly decided. So, that you can overturn that stuff. It's not like precedent is for, is 100% ironclad forever. But that also doesn't, it doesn't mean you can do it by executive order. And that makes two of these that we're doing basically in the last week.
Well, yeah,
we're going to try, we're going to try, basically let's tweet out the new constitution.
Well, but, the thing is, though, the reaction should have been, wow, do you know how hard it is to get a constitutional amendment and how severe that is, and how does an executive order equal a constitution? That wasn't the reaction at all. The reaction was, well, that doesn't make any sense anymore. We don't have any slaves anymore. Okay.
There may be some precedent for that, and I'm not gonna argue necessarily against it. What you have to get to in that case is what was legislative intent when the amendment was created and the amendment was passed, and it is. There's a lot of verbiage behind it that would dictate whether it is. So you can challenge it, and probably, I guess if I wanted something challenged in the Supreme Court, the first thing to do would be exactly what they did, is let's put through an order, because you already know that a whole bunch of states already have their filings in on that, and as soon as you do, then it's going to get adjudicated. But somebody has to have standing and cause to adjudicate it. So if you want to have it changed, you're either going to have to go totally through the amendment process, which means you have to create the amendment, you have to get it ratified by enough states, all that kind of stuff, and it takes a long time. Or you do exactly what they're doing and then have it find its way into court, and let's bind it through the court system. I don't know which is the better tactic for it. But it's, it'll shake out. It's not,
I don't know that, I think it's, if you start doing enough of it, it becomes a massive waste of time. But the thing that I, maybe because I drive home in the city, Kevin, and you don't have that pleasure, thank God, it's, I don't know if it's a parenting generation or whatever it is, but this, I don't know what the word would be. Lou would probably know. It's a moral relativism. It's a something. Like, there are no absolutes. Thou shalt not lie. Wait a minute. What if the other guy lies to me first? Then I get to lie. No. It says you're not supposed to lie. Doesn't mean you get to have 15 different things, like it's the tax code, the exceptions underneath it. Thou shalt steal. Wait a minute. What if the other guys are stealing? What if everybody's stealing? What if you're not cheating, you're not trying? I mean, we've wandered into this malaise. That stop sign shouldn't be there. I get to go through it. It's not just who's in the White House. It's not at all. This is up and down the chain, there's nothing I can do about it. But I do observe it. I mean, it's you fortunately are in a, not that you don't get out, you do, but the people you deal with in school, those are the people that you and I care about. They're actually trying to do stuff. They got families. They're trying to better themselves. They're not going to come in and start lying to you and doing all kinds of crap, because that's not the way they're built. The rest of the world is loaded with this. A lot, It's scary, and these are, I don't know if it comes from parents that the word was no is never spoken or what. I don't know where it's coming from, but
I think it's generational, but it isn't just where you say, well, millennials are this.
No, I'm not going to. I tried not to do that.
There is a certain amount of ethic that you can ascribe to different generations, but I think you're correct also in saying we're talking about parenting, because the ethic of one generation is the ethic instilled by the parents' generation, and then you factor in the typical, you know, rebellion, the things that people don't like about their parents' generation that they're gonna change. So, you know, there's kind of this continuum here, but there is a whole lot of influence of parents' generation on the subsequent generations. And I think when you start looking back at our generation, I think we did have a lot of parents who didn't want to say no. We did have a lot of parents who wanted to be buddies, not authoritarian, not authority figures. And I am sure that's part of your equation.
I mean, if that rule doesn't, I mean, it's simple stuff. If you're delayed at a green light, the guy in front of you doesn't move or something, so now it turns red for you. No, it's not red for me. I deserve to go through it because I should have made the one before. Okay, I mean, we see it in the in a lot of the securities markets now. The thing about having open outcry, and of course people say this guy's a real old duffer when he's talking about open outcry. The fact is, when you can see the people you're trading with, and somebody front runs something, you know exactly who did it. You don't know who put the order in, but you could see it right in front of you. What you see now is with everything being electronic, is you have no idea who you're trading against, you know, and it's, I guess the anonymity is good for some, but it's not so good for others, if you know what I mean. It's it's just an interesting world here. Kevin, you got to talk for 2 minutes because I got to figure out a way to get Andrew in from downstairs. Is evidently the thing's not working.
So all right. Well, what monologue topic should I take? You got to give me the a coffee talk. I'll give you a topic.
What's your final read on the playoffs? And when are they going to 12, or are they?
What do you mean? When are they? Oh, who's going to 12?
Football.
Pro football. College football's already there.
Is it? When does that start?
College football going to 12? It already is.
Well, going to 16. Sorry.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know, but I'll tell you what. You go. I'll talk a little bit about Hall of Fame.
Okay.
So for the listeners, you may or may not have seen that yesterday the Hall of Fame had announced the this year's inductees, and the headliner there is Ichiro Suzuki, but also CC Sabathia and Billy Wagner, and Carlos Beltran just came up short. And Carlos Beltran's a terrific player, so I am sure he will get in on one of the upcoming ballots. For those of you who don't remember Billy Wagner was a relief pitcher, mostly with the Astros. I don't know that he pitched for anybody else, but he was a
small... You got to talk a little longer. I got to go get him. You got another 2 minutes.
Okay, go do it. I got
practice,
it.
Practice.
I got you, Tom. I got you. So Billy Wagner was an outstanding... relief pitcher, mostly for the Astros, may have been all for the Astros, and I'm pulling up Baseball Reference here to see to check him out, because I'm doing this on the fly. But we'll check out Billy Wagner here, and as I put him in, let's see. So Billy Wagner coming up right now, and Billy Wagner pitched for, all with Houston right up until, looks like about 10 years or so with Houston. Then he went to Philadelphia for a couple of years, and then he pitched. He closed his career with the Mets, other than very, very short stints in 2009 and 10 with Boston and Atlanta. But Wagner had... pitched in 853 games. He finished 703 of them, and had 422 saves. Terrific pitcher. And for those of you who are familiar with the WHIP calculation, that's walks and hits per innings pitched. and anything that's even approaching one. If you get down to 1.1, 1.2, you're outstanding. His career whip was 0.998, so I think Wagner's a deserving one. CC Sabathia is another interesting one, a big left-handed pitcher. And Sabathia was on a really, really fast track to 300 wins, but never got there. In fact, wound up with 251. People have softened on him a little bit with the understanding that if you don't win, that the wins have been discounted anymore. So we really don't look at wins and losses the same with starting pitchers. But the interesting topic is, and it's getting a lot of airplay, is Ichiro Suzuki, who was not a unanimous selection. Ichiro fell one vote shy. So somebody, someplace, doesn't think that he was worthy of the Hall of Fame, or at least not worthy of the Hall of Fame on a first ballot. Now, Ichiro, I didn't see him a lot because he was playing in Seattle and his games were on TV late all the time, so I didn't see him play much, but he was an incredible outfielder, as well as a guy who in his career managed to get 3,089 hits, and he played for a really long time in Japan before coming to the United States. So he came, you know, well into his, you know, into his late 20s. So he's a guy who very easily could have been a 4,000 hit guy if he had played the whole time. And then as an outfielder, an incredible arm, incredible range as an outfielder, and yet somebody didn't think that he should be a unanimous selection.
Now, what's kind of everyone back. Your monologue's over. You can take a breath.
No, it's not, because I was just about to say, Tom, Ichiro fell one vote short of being a unanimous selection for the Hall of Fame yesterday.
Who's that idiot?
Well, that's a good question. How many players have been unanimous selections?
I'm going to say like three or four.
Yeah, you're way high. Mariano Rivera, that's it.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, didn't we did this. Did we do this last year? We're like
we might have. When did Jeter get voted in?
Well, I mean, we went through. You're right. It was the only unanimous selection was Rivera. But yeah. I mean, we're talking
Jeter
about
came up one short. Ken Griffey came up. Junior came up three short. Seaver came up five short. Nolan Ryan came up six short. Cal Ripken came up eight short. So Ty Cobb, he was short four. His vote total was 98.2. Smaller sample size of voters at the time. But
actually, you know who? Trick question. There was one other. Well, we think there was one other.
Go.
Trick question. There was one guy who was voted in by just unanimous consent with people in the room.
Veterans Committee type?
No. Lou Gehrig.
First class?
Lou Gehrig.
Lou Gehrig, okay.
And everybody just said, okay, he's in, but now as to whether one person didn't stand up, nobody has a count, but it's considered unanimous.
Okay, and is that because his career ended so they didn't make him wait the whole 5 years?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, because they didn't know if he'd be alive for the whole 5 years.
Yeah. I think they did something early, and they just did it by, they must have been, had the people together or something. In those days, I think they actually met. I don't know if they meet anymore. And they just said, what about Lou Gehrig? And everybody just, I don't know, something happened. They all just stood up and said, do it, or something like that. Something out of the ordinary. So everybody considers that unanimous, but there's no real proof that every single person stood up or something, or every single person said, aye.
Yeah, but nobody raised a hand and said, no.
No, we did that.
Okay. So I guess you, yeah, I'd count that as unanimous then.
Did I ever tell you my black ball story? Actually, Alger B. Duke Chapman, he used to be the chairman of the CBOE. We're talking about a blue blood of blue bloods, right? I think he actually played football at Fordham or something. And his dad was the head of CCB. Was it, what the hell was the name of that place? Those are the guys that bought ABC, remember? I don't know if you remember, but they bought ABC. And everybody wondered why the hell they bought ABC, you know, back in the, they bought it at a time when, you know, we're in a big recession and everything. Well, ABC owned a square block of real estate in Manhattan. It was fully depreciated on the books. And the building was worth more than they paid for the company. Anyway, his dad was the head of this place, and he ended up taking a job. This is how I originally learned about the kudos people get when they take these, like, not embassy jobs, but the cabinet jobs and things. If you take a job at a cabinet level position, now of course this was back when people actually cared about divesting and things like that. I mean, now I don't think anybody cares. I mean, nobody's asking Trump to divest anything, or I mean, maybe they did a little bit, but. They did in those days. People actually divested stuff before they went in. So if you were like the guy from, what was his name, Arthur Levitt, was a big shot at DLJ, Donaldson, Lufkin, and Jenrette. Say that 10 times fast. And he was able to get rid of his stock. Now, I don't think it's a permanent, no, don't have to pay tax on it, but it's pretty close. You have to jump a generation or do something. You don't have to pay taxes on the stuff you sold. That's why... Who the hell was in office where they put the guy in from the Chessy system as a director of transportation for like a couple of months? They did that just so the guy would get his tax dodge or something. I mean, it's a real strange, not many people know about it, but it's in the tax. Anyway, he was chairman of this big club right next to, if you're ever in New York, there's the Plaza Hotel, and then there's the Central Park, and then around the corner, there's this big club. You know, what do you call it? It's like the University Club or one of those places. But the thing is friggin' massive, right? And his dad was the chairman. And that's where they invented this who put the thing together was Carnegie. Carnegie built the place. And that's where they invented the black ball. You know what that is?
Yeah.
Well, they claim they invented it there. So this is how crazy it was. If Kevin came up for membership, all the guys in the membership committee would sit in a room, and you'd have two balls, a black and a white, under the table. So you didn't have to tell anybody who the hell you were voting for, right? So this little tray came around under the table, and you dropped wherever ball was in there. And if it got up to the chairman, who also put a ball in there, if there was one black ball, the guy was refused membership, hence the name Black Ball. Well, this guy comes in, and evidently he's a good guy, and one of the dudes on the committee hates the guy. They had some business dealing like years ago. So they go around to the chairman, and sure enough, there's the black ball in there, right? So Duke's dad says, well, it looks like there's only one black ball in here. I think it's mine, but since it's the only one, I'll pull it right out. If anybody has a problem with that, let me know. And the guy didn't have the balls to say, no, wait a minute, that was my black ball. So the guy got in.
Interesting approach.
I thought it was pretty cool. Well, there's only one black ball here. I think it's mine. I'll withdraw it. Now it looks like they're all white. Does anybody have a problem? The guy refused to, the spineless piece of crap refused to say anything. So the guy got in. So there you go. They actually had a black and a white ball under the table. I heard the expression, but I never actually knew until I heard this story that it was legit.
Yeah, I've seen blackball votes in the movies. I always assume that they were, depicted properly because there was no reason for them not to be.
Yeah, I mean, so what? When do you think we're going to stop the pomp and stuff in Washington? Is this going to go on for like a month and then we're going to get down to like real business, or what are we going to do?
Ceremonial stuff. Yeah. I think it's kind of done.
You think so already?
Yeah, there's, they're pretty much getting on to business. That, you know, it's all about ratifying cabinet members now.
What's the procedure? And I always often wondered. I mean, you know, Lou's been trying to edumacate me, as my aunt used to say. When they pass one of these laws that are any kind of law, but I'm just saying the ones that are 1,000 pages, what do you do with the damn thing? I mean, how do you encode it? How does it work its way through the regs? Where does it go to where all of a sudden it's in? Where does it go? It's in like in the Federal Register or something?
It gets encoded in the Federal Registry, so that's part of it.
Well, what happens to executive orders?
Same thing.
Really? Where are they? They're not law. I mean, if you got your law books from
In some cases they have the force of law. It sort of depends on where you go, and I know you feel this way and I feel this way, that Congress has ceded too much authority to the executive branch and just allowed executive orders. I'm trying to think. I know Obama used a lot of executive orders that I thought should have been the domain of Congress, and I'm just not remembering whether the younger Bush did. So executive orders have been around forever, but when did people start using them to make law becomes the question.
Well, when you say you've been around forever, and I'm not pinning you down. Well, I am pinning you down because I'd love to, because I don't know the answer. I'm hoping you. When did Roosevelt do executive orders? Did Lincoln? I mean, I have no idea.
Yeah, and I don't know. I'm not an educated enough historian to be able to tell you the answer to that. Unfortunately, I should be, but I'm not. So away we go. I don't know. Was the internment of Japanese citizens an executive order?
The weird part about that, Kevin, is the book I read, and it was that Roosevelt pretty much stayed away from that. That was the work of, he was so involved in the war in Europe and other stuff, and somebody in Congress and somebody in the cabinet, I forget their names, this was a hair up there behind, and they kept pushing, and he just never stopped it.
That seems like the kind of thing that, that you would think would have a hard time getting through Congress. So I don't know the answer to that, but that's the kind of thing. War powers, that conveys a lot. But there are plenty of areas, especially related to national security, where the president actually has the power to issue executive orders. There's a certain amount of it that's just proclamations, and nobody cares about those. Pardons certainly fall under that category of within the president's purview. So there's a lot there that they're allowed to do. But when you talk about passing laws, in many cases the law is, and this is a bad habit we've done too. And I think the court has, the current Supreme Court has been frowning on it, and that's why you saw Chevron overturned as an example, because they've been passing bills that basically say, here's some guidance, we're going to turn it over to an agency and let the agency write the regulations. Well, that's always been true, but I think it's the meter has so shifted over there to the agencies and away from Congress that even if everybody in Congress were to read every bill 100%, that by the time it gets turned over to the agency and the regulations are written and they go through the comment process and then get encoded into law, that it's not what they voted for. So I think there's some issues like that come into play. But yeah, it's all process. There's process behind everything.
Well, there's a, when you mentioned that, one of the places that I can speak about, I won't say like an attorney, but pretty strongly is in my business. When you talk about trading with orders, insider trading, those mm-hmm. kinds of things. If you ask somebody, I believe I don't think there's ever been a law passed by Congress that defines insider trading. It's all just been SEC and other people and case law and arbitration law and you name it, which, like you and I know, is a bunch of crap.
So there's probably somewhere out there, there's a bill that said we want fair and free markets, and then the regulators have determined how they would interpret that.
And I'm going to say they've done a horrendous job. And it's been co-opted forever. The right people get the front run. They know people that get information ahead of other people. They know they trade on it. Politicians join the group, but there always were people there before joining. There's people, I mean, was it Schultz, right? He died not that long ago. He was Reagan's Secretary of Treasury, and he was
also Sergeant of the Guard at Stalag 13.
Yeah. He held two cabinet positions. Was he Secretary of State too? He might have been.
I think he was. I think he did some.
But a very accomplished man. He was on one of those talk shows on Saturday morning that nobody ever listens to. But I used to take my mom to breakfast. Nobody cares. When she used to live south and I was living downtown, so I'd get in the truck at 7 o'clock and off I'd go, and I'm listening to the show. Sure enough, they're interviewing this guy. And this is Kevin. This is 35 years ago. I mean, we're talking a long time. And the guy says to him, Secretary, I just have to ask you this. You don't have to answer if you don't want to. Which, you know, he wouldn't answer if he didn't want to. He says, you know, how do you, when we get a number that comes out like the labor number or something like that, how many people get to see that number before it actually is published? And the guy goes, gee, funny you should mention that. This is the secretary. He goes, when I got that spot, the first thing I said was ask the same question you did. By the way, who gets to see these numbers? He goes, well, of course, you know, the president has to see it. You can't have him walk into the helicopter and say, what do you think of the labor numbers, and have him say what labor numbers? I mean, you don't want that happening. He said, I see all these names on this list, and I'm going, who the hell are these people? This is what he said on the air. He says, I started trying to get these people off the list. It was the hardest thing I ever did politically, and finally I gave up. That's what the guy said.
That's so funny.
And so when you say insider trading, it's anybody who trades inside who's not supposed to. That, you know, there isn't one of the Cabots or the Lodges or the Bushes or whoever. It's really kind of strange. But, you know, you mentioned the issue with the internment, the Japanese internment. Did you ever read a book? And it's probably out of print, but I think I still have it. Did you read a book called Pearl Harbor Ghosts?
Nope.
Pretty interesting. It goes back and it reviews all essentially the screw-ups before Pearl Harbor. You know, the Japanese did an amazing fact that they were able to get, you know, that big of an armada that far. They were lucky that they followed a storm all the way in, but they without being detected, you know, by anybody. I mean, just a passing submarine or passing anything, but they weren't. Anyway, it was a total surprise. And so they knew there was going to, we had gone through, what, 2 or 3 weekends of total alert and weren't total alert that weekend, something like that. But according to the book, the idea of the alert was that so many Japanese people that lived on the island, their concern was that those people would be part of the insurrection. That if they were attacked, they were going to, like, rise up, which, of course, they never did. So that was the reason why the planes were all parked on the tarmac, like a couple of the bases, and was so easy to knock down because they felt they could be sabotaged in the hangars, so they were parked on the runways, essentially. So the Japanese show up and go, oh, my God, these idiots parked these planes right in a row. And that's why they parked them in a row. But the weird part of it is the Japanese actually did have one or two bona fide spies on the island. And you ever see the movie From Here to Eternity, and then it's also in the second Pearl Harbor, where that overlook, where every time there's a movie about Pearl Harbor, there's always somebody making out with some babe up on this thing the night before, right? It's where Burt Lancaster was up there with whoever it was. But the road back down into Pearl is this winding road down this mountain, and to the left on one side of it is this big overlook. And it's in like 4 movies, right? And I'm sure if we went to Hawaii, we'd find it. Well, they actually had a Japanese spy that went up there every day. It was a perfect lookout spot for Pearl Harbor. Went up there totally undeterred, took a bunch of pictures and sent them off to Japan. So they were worried about all these people, yet the one guy who was the spy essentially got to walk up into the Sears Tower every morning and take pictures of the city. And nobody ever bothered him. I mean, you read stuff like this, you got to wonder how stupid we can be collectively.
Well, there's always the overlook. I mean, you know, think about Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
you know, and the U2 that got shot down, you know, right in the middle of everything. And Kennedy had ordered all the U2 flights to stop a long time before, and somebody doesn't get the word. You know, it's just, you know, and that threatened to escalate the whole crisis, you know, beyond what it already was on the brink of being. And we're pretty good at the screw ups.
But in those days, they were really kind of well covered up. And if you like somebody, I mean, I can't believe. I mean, in this day and age, not that this day and age is so much better, there's no way in hell Eisenhower would have lasted to D-Day. And to this day, he's revered as this brilliant commander. Jesus, didn't they have a practice landing, right? And his decision was to use live fire in a practice landing. And of course, the Germans spotted the practice landing and torpedoed a couple. They lost more people in the practice landing than they did at D-Day, didn't they? Or close? Can you imagine?
I don't know if they lost more because they lost a lot at D-Day. So
it was, you know, but it was a lot. So I mean, I don't know how that guy would not have been fired today, despite all his
people calling for his head. That's for sure.
Yeah, I mean. Anyway, we have. How does all this pomp and circumstance? I mean, I don't see any executive orders regarding drug prices. I don't see any hint of that.
Well, they're actually talking about what they're going to do about that.
What? Okay, we've been talking about it for half of our lifetime. What are they talking about?
Well, you got to remember that the original cap on insulin that Biden put in was actually a Trump initiative. So, I don't know what they're going to do about it, because I don't know what they will successfully achieve. There's always the what we should do, and then there's what's possible, and I'm not sure what's possible, given the influence of the pharmaceutical industry on Congress. So that's always going to be the big. The toughest nut to crack is how do we separate all of these Congress people who are beholden to pharmaceutical companies? How do we separate them and get them to do the right things, depending on what they have? Because you can put artificial caps on things, and I'm all for it, by the way. But it's, you know, it's similar to them. You know, they're having some conversations about putting a 10% cap on credit card interest. I'm all for it. I don't know what the legal construct is going to be for it. And I think that's really what I'm getting at, is you have to have something that's going to pass muster in court, because you're going to be sued by people who have very, very deep pockets.
Well, once you, and this is my, you know, kind of with every one of the with the guests on the show, the tone of the conversation always kind of changes a little bit. And, because we're all trying to get to the same conclusion. I think things better for everybody, and more money for everybody's clients, not just mine. By the way, some sports. But the when I talk to Hal, and Hal's, you know, very much of a free, he's turning into Milton Friedman right in front of my very eyes. I don't know if he knows that, but he's exact
does
same.
Does he look more like him too?
Does he what?
Does he look more like Milton?
No, Milton Friedman was like 5'2".
Yeah, I know. Poor Hal, he's sitting there going, "I'm shrinking."
Yeah, but once government gets involved, once you do one thing, you sort of can't stop. You can't say, "I'm giving you a patent on something that is, you know, people need for a livelihood, or not a livelihood to live." And, oh, by the way, you can charge whatever you damn well please. I mean, we realize that when the country realized that in railroads. I mean, that's why, like, you know, Kevin, if I were to ever got the okay to teach some stupid class, unlike the good classes that you teach, I could pretty much spin the morals of the business world in a one semester class just by the history of railroading. Everything that is done today business wise. Dirty tricks, monopoly power, all those kinds of things, government reactions, were all housed in the first 25 years of railroading. There's like nothing new. It was all thought of back then. Pretty crazy stuff. But I'm saying, I mean, once you let the dog out of the box, that you have the patents and you have the, then you have to have some way of controlling the prices. I'm not saying you should. I'm just as much of a free market guy as hell, secretly. But once you give somebody a railroad, and there's no other roads around it, you can't have the guy say to the farmer, how much for my soybeans to market? I don't know, how much you got? You can't do that. Then you end up with an ICC where you have regulated rates, which is a big pain in the ass and no place anybody wants to go. But you caused it. You can't give somebody a monopoly and then just walk away.
Yeah, I agree with that. So, yes, if the government is going to do for you via regulation or via the law, then if the government's doing for you, then the government has the right to enforce the rules. You know, borrow money from the mafia and see what your repayment options look like. I'm all for the government not being involved, but once the government's involved, then they do, and I will concede this totally, they do have every right then to turn around and say, so here's how it's going to work. This is the discussion, we've had this discussion before, this is how I feel about things like credit card rates, is, I'm sorry, banks, you have a regulatory infrastructure that protects you from, it protects you from a lot of opportunities to fail. It guarantees you certain kinds of supports, you know, like FDIC insurance being an example, that alleviates anybody's concerns about putting money in your institution. And if we're going to do those kinds of things for you, then you damn well better do some things that are in the public interest. And, I know that's contrary to free market capitalism, but I don't care once you start down that road. Like you said, once you start down that road, that's where you are. You've accepted the terms.
Well, the trick is you got people. I mean, I don't know, the banking industry is just not competitive. I mean, the weird part is, Kevin, it ought to be. Why do people not want to use the smaller banks and stuff? Now, in some areas of the country,
I actually heard the CEO of Stifel on TV this morning on one of the business channels, and he was saying that's a policy that they're looking at, just that. How do we, from a policy standpoint, re-energize community banks because of the outflow of money that's gone to the major banks? So it's on the agenda somewhere, but I don't know what policies they're looking at.
Well, the idea that you have a Federal Reserve, and you know, they must make them drive in blacked out limousines or something, because when you I actually did this half-assed study because I don't have all the information, but years did I do, Kevin? Was it 2010 to 2020 or something, where the rates, we went from whatever rate we started out at in terms of federal funds, and how much lower it got, down to 1%. And I think I had credit card interest rates were actually up on the decade. So the idea that you have the Federal Reserve that lowers the interest rates and tells you how good they're doing for people when they only lowered for certain people is a little weird. And when you talk about, I mean, Hal was the guy, I think, that came out and said you can't have, or was it Hal or Carl? It's Carl, I think. We said you can't have some people in society, when you're lying about the rates, and oh, by the way, you're lying about the inflation, you can't have some people that can borrow under the inflation rate. Because when you do, all you're going to do is maximize these assets, and you're going to have the stock market like it is. You're going to have baseball teams and football teams worth billions of dollars. Because people can essentially borrow under the inflation rate, and they're willing to spend that for that money. And all your stuff just inflates. But we don't. I don't see how. Remember that chart I sent to you guys a few weeks ago regarding not just that the credit card rates are going up, that the spread between the prime rate and the credit card rate has never been higher. So the premium, like regular people pay versus other people, has never been bigger. I mean,
the notion that that rates up and rates down affect everybody equally is just nonsense. Rates down, I guess when you get downward pressure on mortgage rates, that's a good thing, but that doesn't help the average person, especially at a time when the cost of everything is so high and it's hard enough to make ends meet on a week in, week out basis for most families, or for the lion's share of families, I guess that would be most. And then we turn around and say, yeah, but I got to, the heater's broken. I have to have somebody out who's going to charge me thousands of dollars or $1,000 to fix my furnace, or, my car needs repairs, and that's going to cost me an arm and a leg, because that's the stuff that goes on the credit card. So these are the people we're really screwing with credit card rates. You can look and say, well, yes, but it's all risk rated, and this gets to be chicken and egg. Now we're throwing people into credit card debt who can't pay it off, and then we're using their inability to pay it off as a reason to have credit card rates that are so high you can't pay them off.
Well, it gets even better, Kevin, what you just said, because I was him on years ago. As a matter of fact, the gentleman came on the show once or twice, a Federal Reserve guy that no longer works there, and I kind of lost track of with COVID, but one night I said, these credit card rates are awful high, and he's reasonable big shot at the Fed, and he goes, well, do you have an idea how much these guys write off on these credit card loans? And I said, well, I bet they write off one hell of a lot, but let me ask a question. Somebody goes out and buys a hunk of furniture or has a hospital bill and puts it on his credit card and then can't pay it. By the time they write it off, how much has that ballooned in terms of interest and late fees and everything? And he goes, quite a bit. I said, so when they write it off, they're really writing off probably 2, 3, 4 times maybe what the original purchase actually was?
Well, so what happens to it, Tom, the accounting on it is interest is tracked in one general ledger account. All the fees that you assess are tracked also, and they can be taken to income from an accounting standpoint. But when somebody defaults and you back them all out, you're backing out the fees. The fees are so you're offsetting fees that you assessed and you're never going to collect. So the only real loss that anybody has is the rest of them are accounting losses. Even the interest, once the account goes bad, even any additional interest that you're charging is something you're not going to collect. So the real loss is the balance itself, the principal balance.
Okay. Again, you and I scurry to different levels of the chessboard. I know you're right. At the end of the day, you can't charge somebody a late fee, and when they don't pay it, it's not income. You don't get it, right? I understand that part.
You will book it to income. It will go into an income account. You have your loan loss reserve. It's supposed to cover all of that stuff, but it's going to be backed out of income. And so, and I think this is where I can bring this back to where you and I agree on it. This is where I don't want to hear it when somebody says, well, see all everything we lost. The everything you lost is something you never had coming in the first place.
Well, now, but here's
that
where...
you were never going to collect it in the first place.
Right, but here's the chessboard I'm on. If the same buffoon goes before Congress, if they're going to try and lower his rate, he's going to say, do you have any idea how much we lost on this? And he's going to give them the big number, would be my guess. Not the little number. He's going to give them the big number.
Yeah, I think so.
And you're saying that that's essentially a lie.
I think I know where it's. It's true enough that it's not a lie, but it's a misrepresentation of the situation.
Yeah.
Yes, I would like to think there probably are some people, especially the people in Congress, who came up through banking. What's the senator's name from Kentucky? Not Rand Paul, but the other senator. I can't remember his name now. He was a banker. There's a few of them that came out of the banking world before they entered politics.
Wait a minute. Why isn't there a constitutional amendment against bankers being a senator?
Because I want to be a senator.
You're not a banker. You worked for a bank.
I was a... Tom, you know when you make the leap? Is remember in the old days you used to have to put your occupation down on the tax forms?
Yeah.
They don't ask that anymore. And I used to put computer programmer, and the year that I put banker, I realized what I had...
What did you just do to yourself?
it's called self-loathing, but...
Hey, you know, I think we probably have...
But once you understand what, you know, that I'm in the business, and, you know, some of it was computers, but I was also in operations, so, you know, I was dealing with credit card processors and our credit card merchants and all of those kinds of people, and I was dealing with compliance on credit card stuff. So yeah, I was pretty much a banker.
I mean, but the day that you described yourself as a banker, it had to be a bad day.
Nah, it was just an admission.
Hey, do we have Russell? Is he in the room?
Yeah, but I was just taking a big drink of coffee.
What's well, here up? I'm gonna do a A minute rant here, if you guys don't mind.
Go ahead.
And we definitely needed Russell to be on for that.
Well,
absolutely.
Yeah,
my favorite thing.
Well, as I mentioned a little bit, you know, about at what point does this fiasco that's becoming college sports cease to lose its tax-free status? I mean, and maybe we could say they're there or not, but I'm generally appalled at other places that do this. For those that aren't in Chicago, Northwestern University, it's, you know, fine organization, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And they have this massive hospital downtown. And from what I understand, which I didn't even know, you know, you learn stuff every day, especially doing the show. I mean, you learn from everybody. I didn't realize they don't even pay their water bill. I'm pretty sure that's true, that they even get that comped. Anyway, one of my friends... unfortunately, had a heart attack, and he's been there for a while. So I go and visit the dude, and now they have these parking garages. Now, these are all, you know, they're not, no tax, no property taxes, nothing on these places. Well, you get your little thingy, and if you know, there's no real sign around, if you know, and I've been there visiting people and stuff before, so I figured out along the way that if you have the thing, what do you call it, when they stamp it or something? If you get it validated,
they validate your parking.
If you validate the parking, it comes down a lot less. Well, I'm there for like an hour and a half seeing this dude. The bill's $28, and they knock it down to $14. Well, that's a little rich for a place that doesn't pay any property taxes, in my mind. But there's a lady in front of me, this black lady. Doesn't look like she's real wealthy. No, I don't know how you look wealthy, but I mean, she puts the thing in there, and I don't know if she didn't know to validate or what. The bill's $50. Well, then she throws in a credit card, and of course she's only got $35 on that credit card, so she has to put another one in. The machine's adding up all the credit card stuff till she gets to $50. At this point, I can't even really help her. It's too late for me to hand her a $50 and say, you know, hey, I'll do a good deed today. I'm sitting there, I'm just getting so pissed off about this thing. And now, the lady who was the girlfriend of the guy with the heart attack, she essentially was sleeping there. And they were very nice about that. She got to stay there with him over, you know, all night. And it's with validation, it's $30 a day for her to park, to go to visit somebody on a place that doesn't pay any taxes. And not even property tax. And not even a water bill. I mean, am I wrong to be pissed about this or what?
No. We'll go back to exactly what I said earlier about the government subsidizing. If the government's not going to collect taxes, then it should be incumbent on the organization that gets that benefit to act in the public interest.
Well, and the parts about, I don't know which one of you guys was on when Katie was on. We were talking about drug prices earlier, Russell, and, you know, the patents and all this. And once you give the patent, it's like giving somebody the railroad right away. You can't let them charge whatever they want because you just gave them something nobody else has. Katie was talking about how every one of these research projects, and I guess, Russell, you probably already knew this, but it was news to me. I often kind of wondered how they kept tabs on, you know, somebody sends a bunch of money to Northwestern just for money, just for laughs. Somebody else croaks, send him $2 million. Somebody else wants a pavilion. There's money flying all over the place. There's somebody who says, you know, I want to do something specific. I want to stop sickle cell, or I want to stop something else. And you throw money to that disease in a place. Or there's a doctor that goes out and gets money, federal money and matching money for sick. I just picked that disease off the top of my head because it's so far not curable. And the, you know, she says every one of these things has its like own accounting thing, where people contributed this, people contributed that, and so what happens if you pop out a cure? I'll keep using the same disease, sickle cell, and some Pfizer comes in and somehow buys it or does something where they get a patent on it. Well, there's been people contributing to sickle cell and cancer and other stuff for 50 years. They're not investors. The people who donated their time, like Katie, and maybe found it in the summer, or helped find it, or you know, was there for the big discovery. She doesn't get squat. How does some drug firm at some point pile in there and say it's my patent and charge people? Because I mean, how do other people get nothing out of this? Assuming so you're going to be able to charge people 10 times as much as you should for the next 50 years or 17 years. How is it that none of these other people get squat? And yet somebody ends up with a patent. If we really dug into this.
You're talking about a patent for a cure. How about you come in with a patent for a COVID-19 vaccine that doesn't work that you've managed to get everybody to mandate?
Well, yeah.
Who gets that money?
Well, I was trying to keep it clean and say, well, at least we're coming up with a cure.
Well, Chief, part of the deal there, and my wife used to do this. When I met her, this was her job. She was in drug research at Northwestern. And actually, when I met her, they were working on something that was not working, that they were getting ready to halt the trial on. But the funding comes from the drug companies.
Some of it.
A good portion of it does.
Well,
to the point of where I'm pretty sure that Northwestern makes a profit off of just doing the drug research for people.
Well,
are you nodding yes or no over there?
I bet they're overhead.
She's refusing to be involved in this discussion.
Well,
I got to bring this up more often so that I can get out of discussions.
You should see the look.
Okay.
All right.
Well, I mean, but what did Katie say the overhead was that they charge? If you give money for a specific disease and use the Northwestern labs or Vanderbilt where she was, the overhead rates, what'd she say it was, Kevin? Like 300-400%?
Oh, I'm sure. I don't remember what she said it is, but yeah, and you know, why do you do that? Because you can.
Yeah.
Well, I just don't want.
Northwestern does a lot of great work in drug research, but they also make a lot of money off of doing it.
Well, I just don't want them charging people $50 a day apart.
Northwestern has always come across to me as a very profit-driven place, and a lot of the things that you said over the last 5-10 minutes kind of match up with that, doesn't it?
Well, I just...
But on the other side of it is an absolutely beautiful facility.
Yeah.
I got a... I had the accident recently, but I had one a little bit earlier, about a block and a half away from where you are right now. And Northwestern took care of me beautifully. I had to get stitches in my head because I got hit in the head, and got me in and out. So they do great, but it ain't cheap.
That's the day you got jumped?
No, this is one that I'm embarrassed about, and now you know I'm so old I don't care anymore. Somebody pulled into the sidewalk when I was walking to the train, and I walked around behind their car, and the parking garage gate thing came down and smacked me right in the middle of the head.
Really? Ugh.
Yeah, cracked my head right open.
Jeez, is that still in the courts?
No, it's not in the court, because there's a really nice sign when you walk by there that says, don't walk this way, you're going to get hit in the head.
Oh.
There's a graphic there. it says, don't do exactly what I did, so I can't sue.
I'm wondering why this didn't turn into an episode of Russ Headroom.
Yeah.
Remember Max Headroom?
I do remember Max Headroom.
And he crashed into the gate where the maximum headroom was.
Yeah.
I'm gonna have an outing tonight with all the guys that are the late Judge Tooman's friends. I'll bet I could find an attorney that would say that sign was not the proper size.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, it was a long time ago. A good friend of ours that, with the initials MK encouraged me to go sue.
Oh, God.
So, but there's like a sign that specifically says, don't do what you just did.
It wasn't big enough. It wasn't lit. There was something wrong with it.
Well, let's just say I didn't see it when I got hit, but the next time I walked by there, I'm like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, well.
Anyway.
So.
So, Kevin, thank you. We'll talk to you on Friday. By the way, who does everybody like this weekend? How would you like being a tight end on the Baltimore? Did they cut the guy already or what?
I don't know. I think you and I were talking about this, on the telephone. And I say this, and you did the same thing. The Chicagoans will totally understand this, the Chicago listeners, that if you play 16-inch softball, you play without a glove. You play with a bigger ball, and you play barehanded. So your hands, especially if you're playing first base, your hands are really important. You can't be dropping good throws. And the only time you drop an easy one is when where something's going on with your feet. You're trying to find the base. You're trying to get shuffled into the right position or whatever it is. And so you're not focused on catching the ball. And I did go back and look at that guy, and he did have a little something going on with his footing in the bad weather, and I'm sure that took a little bit of his concentration away from his hands, and the poor guy had it right there, and he dropped it.
It was a little low, a little behind, but still, it was right there.
It was a very catchable ball, and one that I'm sure he would get almost every time. But damn, he's got to live with that forever.
Oh, yeah. Plus, he was the guy with the... was it with the penalty? What else did he do, like, right before that?
Didn't he have a fumble or something earlier?
Oh, he had a fumble,
Not his finest day.
No, and the guy's a really good ball player. When you talk about footwork, this has nothing to do with the show. Footwork at first base, my nephew, who's now older, he was in this little T-ball team, right? And there was a young lady, blonde-haired girl, blue eyes, and she's playing first base, and my buddy J.D., who's very big into baseball, we're watching the game, and he goes, watch his first baseman. I go, what do you mean? He goes, just watch her. She had every instinct you can't teach a major leaguer. She'd see where the ball was coming, and then she would select the foot that she would go back to the bag and lean in with the other way, just the right direction. He goes, you can't teach that to a pro. This girl already knows it. She's instinctual. You know who she was? She was the girl who was in the buggy in the Untouchables when it went down the stairs in Union Station.
Oh, the baby going down the steps.
Yeah,
And
I don't know if she ended up playing for some college team or went on to do something else. I don't know, but she had all at that age. She was an absolute natural.
Yeah, well, and in 16-inch, see, when you're playing baseball and you have a first baseman's mitt, you can always put your right foot on the base and just reach for it and use the mitt to scoop, and you can go either direction. When you're playing 16-inch softball, you're not making a lot of one-handed scoops, so you better be good with footwork that gives you the ability when the throw is on the way, gets you the ability to get lined up to where it's going. And because if you want to be able to get throws that are wide, you want to get throws out of the dirt. And you got to move your feet, and that took me a couple of years to master when I started playing.
I'm not so sure I ever did, but plus the bases were only 55 feet when we played.
Yeah.
And then they lengthened them to 60, but then you always had some scatter-armed. The worst was we had this guy. Get a load of this. He wasn't that tall, but it's a big black dude who played third base. Big Mike, hence the name Big Mike, right? He was a stock clerk on the floor, real nice guy. He played the AFL as a fullback somewhere. I mean, the guy was, but he would get the ball and he would run at you. Instead of just winding up and winging it at you. By the time he left it go, he was halfway to the pitcher's mound, and you're like, you had no time at all to react. I mean, it's like.
Yeah, fight that one off.
Yeah, but he scooped it up coming your way, and he'd keep coming, like, just throw it, will you? Jesus. But anyway. As we
all
say,
right, guys,
hey, take care, bud.
All right, we'll see ya.
So, Russell, are you getting an executive order making you prime minister or something coming out of Washington? We got all these executive orders.
No, I'm gonna. I actually, I, I, it'll be public in about an hour or so, but I'm going to be the new ambassador to Luxembourg. I love it when I say something and you are speechless.
You know what I'm trying to.
I got you on that one.
You know what's got me speechless is
what
I've seen Luxembourg on the map. It looks like really, really small. I'm thinking, how big is our embassy in Luxembourg? Is it bigger than the city?
You know what? I will bet you. That was like a kingdom that probably has a lot of nice places. I was getting ready to say that the ambassador's residence is probably the second nicest home in Luxembourg, but
Is Luxembourg bigger than Cook County? I mean, I have no idea how big it is. I know it's small.
I have no idea. I just know it's really tiny and it's up in there somewhere in Europe.
I've never
been there.
I've heard that you're better off banking there than in Switzerland. I don't know if that's true.
Probably. Yeah, well, it's funny. I've been reading about some of the changes that they made where it's a little bit easier for governments to figure out what you have with the Swiss banks now than it was in the past. And when I say now, I mean within the last decade or so, they had to open things up a little bit.
I'm going to ask you a question that we're totally, swing one by you here. Did they ever give the money back, when I say they, Swiss banks, to the German people that got killed in the concentration camps?
I don't think so. I don't think that ever worked itself completely out.
Where the kids would show up?
I think there were some attempts made, but it just... I severely doubt anybody that was... I feel like there's no way I can say this, and I don't sound bad here, but anybody that was victimized by that, that's a better word than I was going to use, was... that they were ever able to match all of that up. I just don't really think they were.
Because didn't they just say that they weren't coming up with anything if you didn't have a death certificate? And there were no death certificates, right?
No, but, this is kind of... One of the ways that they're able to reconstruct a lot of the atrocities that the Nazis did, they were meticulous record keepers.
Yes.
So... I don't think there are death certificates, but they kept records on everybody, unfortunately. They just kept records. I don't really want to talk about this.
No, I don't either.
I just really don't want to talk about this.
I don't want to go
in that direction.
I think, though, in those days, they would take actual valuables, though, in the safety deposit box. You could bring them a painting.
Did. No, they did a lot, yeah.
Yeah, you could bring them a painting or something, and they would take the painting, right? Not just, you just think it'll drawer.
Boy. Yeah.
Now, does anybody even have a safety deposit box anymore? I guess they're still around.
My hope is that they did the very best that they could around all of that.
My hope too.
Wasn't there a George Clooney movie about some of that where they were trying to get some of the things back, etc. That's
man's inhumanity to man keeps popping up, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
So what do you make of? We have, I go back to having, we're having the new president, we're having a nice rally. I'd like to see them do something with the drug price stuff. I don't even know where to start, though, really. I mean, if he were to call us up today and say, okay, guys, we're going to do it, you guys figure out a way to how we start this, I'm not even sure how I'd start it. How would you do it?
I'm not even sure. I mean, you could try to just regulate caps on everything, but then you get a bunch of different lobbyists coming in and saying, "Well, you can't cap this drug at $10 a pill because it cost us $12 to manufacture it." And then you hire somebody like me as a consultant within the drug company to manipulate the numbers and get them to say exactly what you want them to say.
I used to be really good at that.
I still am pretty good at that. The reason I'm good at that is because I teach corporate finance, and I'll manipulate things and then show how you can fall within the rules and manipulate things to show people what to look for.
Were you ever? Does anybody even teach cost accounting anymore?
Yeah. Absolutely.
On a very basic level.
I think we have a whole class on cost accounting and working capital management.
I mean, we're fixed versus variable and all those kinds of things.
Yeah.
No,
one of the most difficult assignments that I give in my graduate corporate finance class is exactly what you're talking about.
Because I thought it was kind of a lost art. And
what's a little different than when you probably did it back in your day is we do it using Monte Carlo simulation. The odds of different things happening, throw them into a big random number generator and the numbers are based on that, and it spits out your most likely worst case and best case scenarios.
I was talking more towards fixed and variable and overhead and those kinds of things. What does it actually cost to do?
Yeah, to make a but there's some of the variable costs you can have ranges when you're doing projections.
That's true.
And that's where the Monte Carlo analysis comes in.
Because a lot of what you see now in this day and age is people think that the chairman's salary is cost, and no, it's not. Not necessarily. we can. Isn't it amazing how many different words we can, how many ways we can define? If I was in your class, just want to get you guys going for like a week and just do one thing, I'd just walk in and I'd say, head of Russell's class, define this word for me in today's world, and I just put the word in big letters, profit, and just walk out the door. I don't know if anybody can do it.
Well, it's not. I mean, profit is an accounting term in my mind. Well, what you really care about is cash flow.
I get that, but I'm saying in terms of if you have a business where you go and get a bunch of investors, and by the way, restaurants are pretty big on this, a bunch of investors, and all of a sudden the thing is making money hand over fist, and all of a sudden the top 10 people get these massive bonuses, there's no profit.
Right? Isn't that amazing?
But you could say that anytime somebody gets a paycheck that is above what the competitive rate might be, that's profit. You might have to say that, because you're saying, where is it going? Like when you say Tesla has no dividends and not much profit, well, you're paying the guy up top $50 billion or whatever.
He's getting a lot, and they're reinvesting, I guess. I have no clue what they're doing with that.
But I mean,
as far as Tesla goes, that's a tough one.
Did you guys ever hear the term? I don't know, maybe bring this up, but you were just talking about Tesla, I guess. You ever hear the term of pure economic rent?
Yeah.
How do you define it these days?
I don't really know. I mean, you're getting into economics, which is not really my strong area. But I feel like isn't that where you compare it to alternative applications of capital?
Well, they used to use the term in Chicago as if it's a Roosevelt or it's an Edison or somebody, you just can't pay them enough. So it's called to pay that person, you know, in those days like $1 million. It's like pure economic rent, because it's you can't even compare it to anybody else. You can't compare Joe Jamoke to like Jonas Salk or somebody like that. I mean, somebody, you know, came up with a polio vaccine. I mean, how can you pay the guy? You can't. I mean, what's the number? I mean, but their point was, everybody thinks, who becomes a chairman of anything, thinks they're Edison, but they're not. They're just a chairman, and they want to get paid like Edison. It's like everybody left fielder wants to get paid like Babe Ruth, but you're not Babe Ruth, you know, type of thing.
Yeah.
What's the verbiage? What's going on the campuses? I mean, a lot of stuff is in turmoil. We have, you know, budget deficits we don't seem to be able to deal with. We have, I mean, if you guys all sit together for a cup of coffee in the morning, 15 learned professors, what's the first topic on the agenda other than this coffee's terrible?
Oh, God, I haven't seen too much of it where I am, but... you have started to see the academic world back away from the DEI stuff. In the past, it just seems like it's not as much of an emphasis as it was a year or two ago. And I don't know if that's, you know, the winds of politics or what, but that's the one. We had a faculty meeting yesterday that I didn't attend because I was teaching a class, but the professor that I ride back and forth to from Chicago with was telling me that. There's a bit of a de-emphasis in that, So that's probably the biggest change. And then we actually, you know, you're asking what are we concerned about? There's actually kind of a bubble of college age kids right now, and we've got a lot more kids applying for spots than we have.
I thought enrollments were kind of down across the board. Where did that
end? I don't know what it is if the COVID situation had people put off college. I don't know, but we're getting a ton more applicants than we have in the past.
I guess
I don't know if maybe everybody's only applying to, you know, very large name schools, and you know, because I do know a lot of smaller schools are suffering big time. There are a bunch of small colleges all over the Chicago area, and I'll bet you in 5 years there are a few less.
I would agree. I guess what I'm trying to find out, you alluded to it, so you gave me the question, so I'll ask it. I'm going to say that on a regular year, 95% of your applications for undergrad are people who are going to graduate this June. Are you saying that maybe that number, there's people who graduated last June or the June before, or even maybe went to...
Yeah, I do think there's a little bit of that going on.
How about junior college? A lot more guys coming. How does that show up if somebody goes to...
I don't really know how that... one of the funny things about the application and all that process, all they give us... We are so separate from that. All they give us are the numbers. They just tell us how many people applied, how many people got in, and what the changes are from year to year. But because of what I do and because I live in the western suburbs and there are a lot of kids out here that want to go to Kelly in Indiana, yeah, I get a lot of questions about the application and getting in, et cetera. And we have so little to do with that. And I like that we have very little to do with that, because I would, if I could, like, help some people and do it, it would probably become a full-time job with me,
the number
of people that ask me about it. But luckily, because I barely teach undergrad, I don't teach undergrad in Bloomington, and I mostly teach graduate school. I get out of those conversations pretty quickly. But we really don't, and it's funny because that I did have that conversation with somebody yesterday. We were talking about how the numbers have changed a bit, and... you know, we had a lot. We had our biggest freshman class last year, and we don't have the capacity to let as many people in this year. But we're getting more applicants. So,
even though you said
there was just a lot of discussion around that in a meeting that I was in. But then part of the discussion was, you know, and one professor said, well, you know, and we just don't really said. I really don't know how all of that works. And it was a relatively new guy. And somebody else that had been around for 20 years said, you know, I don't really either, other than the numbers, and that's by design, and I like that.
Well,
I like that, too, because I don't...
Even though you say you're not part of it, I'm going to ask you a question anyway. I went the 4 years. I guess I'll use the term regular, but that's...
Yeah.
If I went 2 years to... what's the place out west, or... If I went to Ivy, where Kevin is, Ivy Tech, and I did my first 2 years in finance or in engineering or something there, I graduate and I want to apply to Indiana for essentially junior year. How does that work? I don't know if anybody's ever
done that. Extremely. I don't know the mechanics behind it and everything, but in Indiana, there's a relationship between Ivy Tech and the universities where the curriculums match up. So Ivy Tech students that move over to one of the Indiana campuses, I don't want to say it's seamless, but it's not a very difficult transition.
Well, you guys,
now, that's not now in Illinois, that's not true, because we got 1,000 different junior colleges all over the place, as opposed to in Indiana, where we've got a dozen Ivy Techs and we've got a bunch of, we've got a handful of Indiana campuses around the state as well, and they kind of sync things up.
Yeah, man, I'm such a, you know, by going to Notre Dame, I'm so lost in a...
Indiana's, you know, and it's not just because I work there, Indiana does an absolutely just a fantastic job with the whole university.
I think you guys,
and I've also never worked at a Big Ten school, and I think the Big Ten schools are really the class of public schools. I've just never worked at such a great place.
Well, I just, being locked in my Notre Dame background. I mean, if I were to go on, the money was different. Well, money was so cheap when I went. So if it was now, and all of a sudden I didn't have the scratch-o, and I decided, mm-hmm. okay, I'm going to go to Moraine Valley, and I'm going to take all these basic courses and accounting courses or engineering courses, which I'm sure they have. It's a real nice place. I don't even know where that application to join Notre Dame a junior year would even. I don't even know where you'd even send it. I don't know of anybody.
There are ways to apply as a transfer student as opposed to coming out of college student.
But I'm saying I didn't know anybody junior year who showed up and spent the first 2 years in junior college. I mean, I don't think anybody did that there, which isn't other places. Obviously, you do.
Well, Rudy did it when he went to St. Mary's and then across the street and went to Notre Dame.
St. Mary's a girls' school.
What school did he go to? Holy Cross.
Holy Cross. That was Cross. There were a couple people who went back and forth. But, I mean, it wasn't sort of normal.
But see, the Holy Cross kind of has a relationship with Notre Dame. I mean, I don't. I'm making a big assumption because they're in the same neighborhood.
Well, there
probably is, a mechanism in place for that.
If you were an athlete and you got booted out for whatever reason, grades or mm-hmm. discipline, you could go and do jail at Holy Cross for like a year and come back.
Love it.
Yeah, it was sort of the.
And that's great too, because you can see Notre Dame from a distance and go, "Oh man."
Isn't there a Holy Cross that actually is a 4-year institution somewhere?
I think there is.
Because I think George Connor went there and played football there, and then his dad mm-hmm. was sick and he had to move back to Chicago, and then he played his last couple of years for Notre Dame. Way back in the day,
mm-hmm. when it was more difficult to do that.
I don't know if they recognize people. I don't think some of the stuff in sports was still kind of the same. As a matter of fact, your place, Indiana, one of our oldest clients. When I say oldest, the guy's probably been dead forever. 91. He was talk about a character. I've talked about him before, but he was a big developer out in Arizona. But he's from Indiana, and he's playing. He knew some kid that played. He played fullback at Notre Dame or something. He was from the area. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, he went to see an IU baseball game, and the kid catching, he goes, "That kid looks familiar." He was the guy that was the fullback at Notre Dame. This is back, in the 40s or something.
Uh-huh.
But he's playing baseball for IU. And the guy says, "Aren't you the guy?" "Hey, shut up. We don't tell anybody." So, he's there, and he's playing baseball. What do you make of... by the way, I can ask you because I know you're not privy to these kind of meetings. Maybe you are, but where the schools regarding the sports stuff? There's got to be massive discussions just because it's a fantastic economic experiment, for lack of a better term. What's going to happen when I think that somebody? I say this every couple of days, probably too much, but it's fascinating to me what's happening with the football, basketball, and I'm sure it's going to happen in the other sports. I think people are going to be able to play football or basketball the entire time they're there. Right now you have 4 years of eligibility, which COVID kind of screwed up. Well, the NCAA is trying to be somewhat preemptive now and saying you might get 5 years of eligibility. But I think, Russell, if I go to Indiana tomorrow and I say, I'm a football player, and by the way, I'm in the 5-year graduate program, or I'm in a law school program that's going to be 6 years if I go undergrad and law school together, and I'm making money playing football, I want to play 6 years, and when I'm done, I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm not going to go to the NFL at all. I don't see how that doesn't become the law of the land. Do you? As long as I'm a student, I get to play. I mean, where am I wrong here?
I don't think you're completely wrong there, and it's a matter of the NCAA doing what the schools want. So I feel like, the NCAA is not involved in the college football playoff. That's a different entity.
Right.
That is the case of them mismanaging something and losing control of it. So now I really, you know, you see that, and you take a look at the NCAA basketball, which is for the NCAA is the big cash cow, not the college football.
Right.
And do what?
You're right. I mean, what I'm saying is,
I mean, that's their where, you know, whereas. So I think they so if I'm the NCAA and I see that I'm losing control, I lost control of basically, you know, could arguably be the best sport. Although I do think college basketball is more profitable because there's less overhead for the teams. But you've lost control of your highest profile sport, and heaven forbid, you know, you lose control or all of a sudden the Big Ten, the SEC, and the ACC and the Big 12 get together and go, you know what? We're not going to do this March Madness stuff where we got to play, you know, Florida Atlantic and lose, or Florida Gulf Coast and lose in the first round because we didn't know anything about them. And all of their guys are 26 years old or something silly like that. We're just going to, the national championship is now going to be a 16 team thing, and it's going to be four teams from each of these four power conferences. Well, end of story. That's where we're going to go. We're not going to send our teams to the NCAA tournament anymore. I think NCAA decision-making is based on that fear. And if it's based on that fear, you're pretty much going to just agree to what the schools may want. If the schools are all saying, we want 5 years of eligibility, and the NCAA says, no, we're going to leave it at four, then, you know, a bunch of the schools that have an unusual amount of power in the whole situation may get together with their conferences and say, you know what, we want to let our guys play for 5 years. If we let our guys play for 5 years, you know, we can get the best people to transfer for a fifth year to our conference, and we're going to do our own national championship. You know, they can just take all those other slouchy schools.
Well, here's kind of where
that's the kind of stuff that the NCAA should genuinely be worried about.
Well, here's where I'm coming from, Russell, and I don't at this point, since the courts have essentially blown up the authority figures, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
I don't know who can get together now and make a rule that sticks. I mean, if they say no, you can only be here. You can only play football or basketball or baseball for 4 years or even 5 years. And you and I walk into a judge and I say, hey, look, a full-time student looks to me like it's 9 hours, according to these guys, or 12, mm-hmm. or whatever it happens to be. You know, nine goes into whatever is 6 years. Why do I only get to play four? I'm a student for six. And the thing was all set up before to essentially be a farm team for the NFL. Well, they're not that anymore.
Yeah.
They're not that.
No, they're kind of close to a competitor.
I'd say the NFL better figure out they're a competitor. Mm-hmm. But I mean,
and hey, the tax thing that you bring up, the tax free status thing because of what's going on with the football, I think that when that really gets questioned is when the private equity guys actually do invest in some of the college sports programs. When you see that, that's when you really do. When you know they're going to have to start questioning the tax status, or at least the tax status of the sports departments.
Well, I mean, if you listen, which I know you do, it's not insulting. Mm-hmm. It's not if you listen to just the little bits and pieces that are coming out of all this stuff. Mm-hmm. There's and if you're an IRS guy, not that you know, I'm not accusing you of that.
No,
your nose has got to be absolutely to the wind on this, because mm-hmm. even simple stuff like the was it the Notre Dame quarterback or one of the other guys' quarterbacks said something about he's making all his money, you know, God knows, a couple million a year from God knows who, and he just gave, you know, all the offensive linemen like 50 grand or something, or 25. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting there going, whoa, is that a gift? Is that income? Is the income to the
it's got to be income.
Sure,
you can't
it is.
Get the gift limit's what, 10 grand?
What I'm saying is it?
Yeah.
Is it? You're getting money. I'll pick a term. Russell Rhodes gets a huge shoe contract from Under Armour, making sure he goes to Notre Dame or wherever. I don't know if Indiana's an Under Armour school. You're going to go to either Notre Dame or Indiana. Well, by the way, who's your big sponsor? Is it Nike or Adidas?
We're an Adidas school.
Okay, so.
In fact, I won't go work for a Nike school.
Okay, well,
I'm actually serious.
I know. I don't.
I won't go for a Nike school because of the amount of slave labor they use in China.
I'm with you, but what I'm saying is,
you guys are Under Armour,
right?
Under Armour.
So if I'm, do I set up a Tom Howe Inc. where Under Armour pays the ink, and so then if I give my offensive linemen $50,000 a piece, if I had that kind of dough, but all of a sudden I give them a 1099 from Tom Howe Inc. I mean, so this all has got to work its way down the chain here, and I don't know that a lot of these people understand that, but then, that's income to me or my whatever it is. Do I get a salary from the place, or do I have to pay corporate income tax, or is it a subchapter S? And if I pay out,
I think they're working on a way that the schools are going to directly pay the players.
Okay, but now all of a sudden,
I've read a couple of things where they seem to be, but because it and this is. When we talk about this topic, you're all over the place, and the reason you're all over the place is this topic is all over the place.
Well, I think it's
you know, I mean, they and it's you know, it's the complete what I just taught Chicago Board of Trade history, so I'll go back. I'll kind of compare how the Board of Trade evolved to what's going on in college sports right now. The Board of Trade evolved because there was this unregulated market where people were trading receipts that where they had made promises with farmers to pay them a certain amount for their crops, and the sizes of the contracts were all over the place. The you know, the integrity was kind of a mess, and they centralized it into what became the Chicago Board of Trade. I think the paying the athletes were at that pre the pre-standardization process, and within the next 2-3 years. The way that the what these people get for representing the school as an athlete will be somewhat uniform again. And when I say uniform again, you know, just the number of years, the transfer stuff, but also how the compensation actually works.
Well, we're gonna have to make a little bit of a bet, because I don't think at this point, given the court decisions, that the schools are going to be able to come back together and essentially collude.
Yeah,
but when you say I'm all over the place, you are correct. But you know what has me all over the place, Russell, is that I've never seen a situation like this where the people that are paying people are essentially not the people that the guy works for.
Yeah,
that's the problem. Because
that's a huge issue.
But I'm going to say that this movement towards the schools paying the people instead of having all these outside people paying them. I mean, you are correct. And some of the, I don't know much more about it than you do, but I mean, you are correct. And some of the people that were paying them are now, they're gone. But here's the, you're never going to cross the Rubicon until you make them employees. And I don't think the universities are anywhere near that yet. They don't want a workman's comp claim from a guy who's 45 saying that he had an injury playing football at your place. But until they decide to go that route, how are they going to pay them and say they're not employees?
I think what they're going to have to do is set up a separate entity that's the sports department.
So it's going to be
you're going to separate it from it's going to be they already kind of are separate, but it's going to be much more separate.
Well,
and probably where the team gets a certain amount of funding from the school each year, and then what they do with it is kind of up to the sports department. But then what you're also going to end up with is fewer and fewer schools that offer sports
at that level.
Yeah, you can't do it because the haves and the have-nots, it's widening. In fact, I think the biggest we had a big discussion. We've got a guy that's a big SEC guy that I like to talk football with, and I really think that the way NIL is working and the fact that the alumni base for Big Ten schools is much wealthier than the alumni base for SEC schools, that you're going to see a shift, that we're seeing the early stages of a shift to the wealthier schools like Ohio State and Notre Dame doing better in football than, you know, Alabama's got a great football program, et cetera. their endowment is a fraction of what Indiana's is.
Well, Texas are up there.
And Texas, yeah, but they're an exception within that conference. The majority of that conference, the bottom half of that conference as far as school wealth, it ain't all that good. It really isn't.
But I'll say this.
Then the other thing is, I was taking a look at, and I haven't finished compiling all the numbers because I do focus on some of this stuff. Indiana gets six times the football revenue from the federal government for research every year.
Well, that's
common with Big Ten schools. That's not common with schools in other conferences.
You know when you have a
because we're a real university.
Well, you know when you have a guest that like anticipates your every thought, a guy like you. I was just about to say, you know, these numbers all seem pretty big until you actually look at how big these schools are.
I mean, I hate to throw numbers out because I don't want to, as a representative of IU, I don't want to throw the wrong number out there. But that's why I'll say generalities like three times, et cetera. I think the athletic department is about 10% of the overall budget for the school.
You would be, I think, very wrong.
I think that's about what it is. Because, you know, we got a lot more going on than just sports.
Oh, and I think you're missing to not to decide. You think you're missing.
You know what am I missing on that?
You know what the total budget is of UCLA.
No.
Take a wild guess, and you should be closer than anybody.
3 to 4 billion.
Try 11.9.
Oh, okay. All right. Well,
you know what it is for.
UCLA is not a good example.
Okay, you know what it is for Wisconsin.
And the reason is because when you apply to go to UCLA, you actually are applying to one of like a dozen schools, and they may all that budget may incorporate that group of schools. Because I think ours is in the 3 to 4 billion range, and that's where I came up with that.
I'm going to say, I'd be surprised because Illinois and Wisconsin are dead even at 7.8.
Oh, I'm probably getting the number wrong. Low.
I think you're low.
Yeah,
that's
I'm
what I'm saying.
So,
I mean, this is not an argument or a contest. I'm saying these places are huge.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, we're talking about hospitals. We're talking about they're cities, for God. They're states.
They are. Yeah. You know what? I think the way we do the med school and the law school is a bit different than some of the other Big Ten schools. And that's why that number that I threw out there is a little bit lower. I don't think it includes those two.
Okay, yeah, I mean, obviously.
Because those two are in Indianapolis and, you know, the main campus in Bloomington. So, but the real point, but your point, and both of our points, without splitting hairs over how many, you know, you got a billion here, a billion there, you got a lot of money. But the athletic departments, as far as the overall budget within the schools, it's not the biggest, it's not the biggest revenue. And it's not the biggest expense.
I'm looking here since you brought up the SEC. I'm looking at the University of Alabama, and they claim that last year, let me get back to this, they actually lost $21 million on athletics.
Yeah. But where I went, Memphis, they've never made money on athletics.
Well, it depends on what you put in there. Because they also, all the cost of intramurals, all the other stuff, they throw that in there.
We didn't have intramurals in Memphis.
You didn't have any?
No,
didn't have gym class.
You should be forced to go to a regular college for a semester or so. Notre Dame is a very special place. Chicago is a very special place.
I'm learning that, but you didn't have you didn't have to take like a semester of phys ed.
No.
All right, well, we had to take two. Boy, if you cut, you didn't graduate there. But let's put it this way: if I'm in the legislator, I'll be the Russell. If I'm a legislator in Indiana, the second they split away from the university and have BlackRock or somebody as an investor, you're paying the amusement tax. Sorry.
Yep. And I think they should. I think they should do that because we get a good chunk of money out of the state legislature every year.
Yeah, I mean, this is all. Yeah.
So and they should have an awful lot of say into what we do. They do.
Yeah, they truly do.
I'm up for a promotion this year, and if I get it, It's not official until it's been approved by the legislature.
A dean?
No. Just a different level of professor.
I didn't know there was level.
There are three levels. I'm at the middle right now.
Well, that's right. There's
assistant, associate, and full. I'm an associate.
Okay. So are you going to be a full guy?
I don't know. We'll see. I got to do a lot. There are a lot of hoops I got to jump through. So maybe.
I guess my question is are the full professorships endowed?
No, mine will not be.
What is it?
Some of them are, but mine would not be.
What does it cost to endow a professorship these days?
I don't know. I could back into it, but I'm not going to try to back into it here.
Well, let's not do the math.
I don't want to misstate a number on that one. But what you got to figure is an endowed chair, figure out what their salary is, and then just figure out how much of a perpetuity you need to cover that salary.
Well, when I was at the University of Chicago, in the I don't know how much dudes got paid back then. What do you suppose they got paid in 78? 50 grand? 60? Most?
50, yeah. Probably and, not a whole lot.
So the interest rate was 12. So
yeah.
I think you could endow a place for like 600 grand or something.
Probably.
A million for sure. Now it's got to be way higher than that.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
at a really, really good university, and this is not an Indiana number, but a really, really good university, an endowed professor's probably making between $300,000 and $500,000.
Well, I mean, how much would that, with interest rates at 3 or 4%, that's a lot of money.
That's the backing end to it. Yeah, I mean, gosh, you're talking.
Lots of money.
Well, you know, a lot.
You know, the one, I think I told you this before, the one, I mean, I love going to George Stigler. But next time you're up in the office, I'll show you. I unearthed some of his pamphlets that he wrote. Pretty interesting about, you know, the, I don't know if I mentioned it to you. He said that we've had, he has differing views on regulation than maybe, I don't know, you and I do. Maybe not, but this one pamphlet I was reading, he was saying that they did a study in the 60s that on electrical service and gas service, essentially regulating monopolies, you know, public utility companies.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, they didn't think that over a 50-year period, now maybe they, you know, and he didn't go into detail, but I suspect that some of the increases were at least delayed along the way, that the entire people, everybody who's ever worked for like the ICC, public utility places and all that stuff, were totally worthless. At the end of 50 years, the rates were where they would have been anyway. I don't know if I'm not quite cynical, but that's what they claim they found out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you would necessarily believe that or not. But anyway,
he was
a Charles R. Walgreen. I don't think it's spelled the same as Walgreen, so I don't think it's the same guy. But he was a Charles Walgreen distinguished economic professor in behavioral economics. He won a Nobel Prize. He croaks. The next guy wins a Nobel Prize, retires or croaks, and the next guy. They've had three Nobel Prize winners and one endowment since 1980.
I think it's more than that now.
Well, no, that just think, on that particular professorship.
I think there's more than three with that professorship that have won the Nobel. I think there are a couple of more now.
Well, I mean, I think the other guy's still there. He hasn't croaked yet. I mean, there's only one guy in the spot, right?
Yeah.
Because Milton Friedman was another spot. Well, he was somebody else's endowed spot. So
the endowed spot that you're talking about, everybody that's gotten that has held that position won a Nobel Prize.
Yeah, since 1977.
Yeah.
But there's only been, I mean, those guys last forever.
Only like three or four, yeah. But
well, the guy who...
I felt like there were more than three. But maybe they're not.
Well, I mean, Milton Friedman was a different one.
Yeah.
The other guys, a lot of the other dudes are all different. I mean, there's only...
Yeah.
How many endowed... University of Chicago was huge on endowed professorships. Is Indiana the same way?
We have. I know the guy next door to me has one. But I don't really know how many we have.
I don't think Notre Dame had very many. They didn't have many full professors. So it was all assistants or associates. What the...
I wonder why that is. Oh, well.
I don't know. But what? Well, that was a long time ago. What? Yeah. All right, we got a couple of minutes. Where do you think, with all this stuff happening, the market celebrating here, is this going to be a three-day celebration like wage and price controls, or is this going to carry us to a new year? What are we doing here? I mean, the numbers are the same.
I think we get back to a little bit of reality after a few more days, you know. Trump's going to Davos?
Where'd you see that?
Trump's going to the World Economic... I just saw a thing go across Bloomberg that said Trump's going to speak in Davos on Thursday.
He's been probably trying to get in for all these years and couldn't get in. He finally can get in.
Well, it just said Trump addressed Davos Thursday. I know I just saw that.
Wasn't this?
I don't watch the same business network as you.
Okay, what wasn't this the
I
year?
I watched the good one.
Wasn't this the year you were supposed to go to Davos?
I got to do something good, and I got to get off the couch and do something.
I think
yes.
I think you and I, one of these years, should go out there and just sit at the bar, sipping on a martini or whatever the hell we want to sip on, because we want to drink it. We want to be COVID or cogent. And just have the people sit down next to us and pick their brains. I bet we learn.
See, I don't think we could get to the bar.
Why?
I think there's basically a huge... It'd be like trying to break in somewhere.
You think I've ever...
I could do that, but I don't know if we could get you in there.
I'll tell you what, if we get
me
in
more,
there...
I'm more stealth than you are.
If you got me in there, I'll get us to the bar.
I'll blend in there. I read a thing about Davos once, and I feel like you can't even get to the hotel unless you're supposed to be there.
Oh yeah, oh god, yeah. It's
I want to know why we don't, you know, why we're not out there in ski jackets broadcasting live from and talking to all the bigwigs.
Well, you know, Dr. J did that one year. He was.
I know.
Well, I'll tell you what. I know. I'll let you start. I'll let you practice. Get us into Jackson Hole.
I would love to go to Jackson Hole. I would absolutely love to go to Jackson Hole.
Now, would it be considered bad form if we snuck into town and went to the cowboy bar and had a beer in the saddle?
I think we could pull that one off.
Because the bar stools are all saddles in the cowboy bar, you know.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, we could and we can write the whole freaking thing off because it's a business expense. Yeah.
By the way, are you any good at pool?
I am terrible at pool.
We have to practice up because last time I was there, we held a table for 2 hours.
Okay.
We have to, you know, we got to make. That's how you make a name for yourself, especially if you're old, you know.
Well, let's be the guy at the pool table.
Yeah.
Tell everybody in a earlier life you were the Chicago Shark.
No, just got to be better than the guy you're playing. You don't have to be that good.
I know.
So what? I mean, what is the first? I mean, we're gonna the massive story about coming into Chicago and kicking out all the immigrants. We're down from. Something like 51,000 to 2,700 that we're even housing here. Why is this even still a problem in Chicago? I don't think it is it?
I think, it's still, we've still got, if there's still people being housed or there are people, bad actors that are in our country that really shouldn't be in here, the problem is not gone. And that, I think that's the first group that they're trying to target is... You know, the bad guys that get all the headlines.
Well, the bad guys, they can't wait for a bad guy so they can give them the headline.
Yeah. So, my understanding was they were going to start, start taking action, you know, the day after the inauguration. But then I heard it was too cold, so they were going to give it a few days in Chicago.
Well, the place by me closed, where they had the people, kept getting less and less people in there. Ever since, I mean, this, of course, isn't going to make the news at all. I think Biden, was it 6 months or a year ago, clamped down on the people coming over the border. You haven't heard of a bus?
They did start to do something about it last year.
I haven't heard of a bus.
I remember when they seemed to start doing something about it, I just felt like, well, why are you doing this now when you could have been doing it?
Well,
what have you been doing the last 3 years was my mental response to that one.
They've got everybody brainwashed into this problem, but I don't think there's a bus is showing up in Chicago in 6 months.
The flow in has definitely slowed.
So, I mean, I don't even know that it's... Yeah. Now, I'm sure other places...
There are people in our country that probably should not be here right now. And I'm not talking about people that are desperate for a better life. I'm talking about people who, if you know, that got let out of jail in Venezuela and were told, as long as you go to another country and don't come back here, we don't care what you do.
We got people that got let out of jail at county last month that shouldn't be here.
Oh, gosh. If I told you the story of the car that I bought...
No, but go ahead.
This has to do with jail. Okay, so it's real quick. So I got a nice SUV at about 20 grand that had 2,000 miles on it, that was 3 years old, that was like $15,000 less than a certified version, certified used version. And I found the name of the guy that owned it in the glove box, the guy that owned it before me. The reason that it only had 2,000 miles on it was he hid the car and didn't make payments on it because he got busted for human trafficking, promoting prostitution, and money laundering. And there's a whole article about how it's like 30-month investigation, dozens of Secret Service guys, etc. Huge bust of him and two other people in the western suburbs of Chicago. Guess what he ended up doing jail time for this huge multi-year investigation?
Don't tell me like 6 months.
6 days.
6 days.
He got time served.
How long was he in jail before they convicted
him? He was in for 6 days till he got bail. And then they went through court, and he got 6 days.
Well,
why have I been following the rules for 57 years?
I don't know. Why, how did you end up with the car?
They finally repossessed it. They finally found it. He wasn't making the payments. He made one payment on it and then just kind of hid it. And they finally found it to repossess it. And it smelled like holy hell on the inside. And I think it took me about a month or two to get the smell out of it. But it was well worth
You bought it from like GMAC or somebody.
I bought it at CarMax.
Oh, okay.
I bought a Porsche at CarMax. So,
wow. Well, good for you.
Yeah. No, I came across it. I'm like, this is the exact car I want. It's so cheap. And we ran over there and got, you know.
I wonder how they got it.
They repossessed it. They took it over because of it was bought at the Porsche dealership near me, and they knew the car. And they first brought it over there and asked them if they would, if they wanted to take it and then resell it as a certified car. And because of the smell and a couple of other minor things, they said no. And that's how it ended up at
I hope we're talking cigarette smoke and not the dead body smell.
No, it was like a nasty cigarette smoke type thing, yeah.
Today's marijuana.
It's not in there anymore.
Today's marijuana.
Yeah. Well, I'd have been okay with that part, but, you know, not the cigarette part.
Anyway. All right, bud. see you soon.
But 6 days, dude.
It's,
And the amount of effort and the bad stuff he was doing, you know, we got to come up with a crime. I'm coming in next Wednesday, and we got to figure out a crime.
We're too straight. We'll get caught.
No. You can get away with anything once.
Oh, God. S&P futures up 32. The S&P futures up 211. How long are you going to stay long your spoo?
I've been short spoo for way too long. I'm getting sick of it.
Oh,
I've
God.
Got some other things that I'm short versus it, but it's not been pleasant.
You got any Netflix up 127 bucks?
I do not, but they were pricing for something like this.
Well, they're raising all their prices. All you do is raise prices,
yeah.
And you're good. Anyway,
yeah, I can do that.
S&P futures up 33. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.